Seated. There is no children's gospel project this evening, but they can. There's on the back at the end of this row here. There's a table. There's activity pages. There's crayons, and there's some little snack packs, so they can do that. And if you need to remove a child, I guess there's a room back there with toys and stuff in there that you can use as well. It's just. You will need to take your own kids in there. We're trying to answer why Good Friday is good. And we know that when we see something good, we like to tell about it. There's a see and tell element to the life of the righteous. To see the goodness of the cross is to declare it. We understand this. When you see, if you're a football fan, if you see an amazing play, you want to tell people, did you see that? If you had a great time at a party or a show, you want to say, hey, let me tell you about this party I was at. Let me tell you about this movie I saw. It was amazing. You have to go see it. Let me tell you about my favorite band. I saw them live. It was amazing. You have to go see it. There's a see and tell component to the life of a righteous. If we see the goodness, if we see the glory of salvation, we must tell it. In Psalm 96, 1 through 3, you see verses like this all over the place. But it says, oh, sing to the Lord a new song. Sing to the Lord, all the earth. Sing to the Lord. Bless his name. Tell of his salvation from day to day. Declare his glory among the nations, his marvelous works among all the peoples. He sees the Lord's marvelous works, and he says, tell of his salvation from day to day. You've got to declare it. As we've been working through Luke, we've seen every time Jesus does a miracle and the person sees who Jesus is, they go and declare it. We saw that in the story of the blind beggar at the end of chapter 18. And Jesus healed him, and it says immediately he recovered, the blind beggar recovered his sight, seeing Jesus. Is the idea there, and followed him, glorifying God. He's telling of what he's seeing. So when one sees the marvelous works of the Lord, telling the glory of those works is the response. If you see, tell. The marvelous works of the Lord find their zenith in salvation. The whole theological concept of salvation, and salvation finds its nucleus on the cross, Jesus on the cross. Perhaps we could say that the cross is the engine of salvation. Without the cross, there is no salvation. There's no energy to salvation, to actually effect it and make the salvific work of God known to mankind. There's many aspects of the cross that we could consider, many that we sung about. There's many things that make Good Friday good. We can break down the work of the cross basically into two elements, atonement and deliverance. In the atonement element, we see that Jesus is a sacrifice for sins. He's a sin offering. He's a guilt offering. He's our substitution. In the deliverance aspect, Jesus has delivered us from the power of Satan and sin and death. He has declared victory over these powers that are contrary to him and to us. He's declared his victory, and he's delivered us. As slaves who were once under those powers, he's delivered us. So we could talk about all these different elements of the cross. But this evening, I want to go behind the actions, behind what was accomplished, and see the motivation for the cross. Why did God want to come and do this thing? Because God really did want to do it. He was motivated to do it for a reason. And I think that understanding the motivation of God's action is just as important as comprehending the outcome of God's actions. And perhaps we could say that one can only truly understand the magnificence and the glory of the work of salvation when we see the comprehensive intermingling of God's motivation to go to the cross and then the outcome of the cross. Because how we see, again, how we see the work impacts how we tell of the work, impacts how we respond to the work. And to see the goodness of the cross, the true goodness of the cross, we must see, we must understand and know that it was the love of God that compelled him to such a work. And so we're going to join with Paul midstream in Romans 5 as he's expounding on God's motive behind his salvific work. And Paul says, "For while we were still weak, at the right time Christ died for the ungodly. For one will scarcely die for a righteous person, though perhaps for a good person one would dare even to die. But God shows his love for us in that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us." Here's the why of salvation. God loved. But God's love is not like our love. God's love is like God's love. We see this in Paul's comparison between how people love and how God loves. People, Paul says, find it difficult to give up their life to die in the place of even righteous people, even good people who do good things. And perhaps we find it reasonably compelling to die for the people we like or have affections for, our children or our families or somebody in a brotherhood. But this is not the person that Paul has in mind. Paul has in mind just a righteous person, the righteous other, a neighbor that you don't know that might be a good person. Human beings don't normally consider it worth their time to go give up their life for that person, even if they're good. In addition, further diminishing the magnitude between human love and God's love is the scope of what dying for another person entails, what giving up your life for another person entails. Because giving up your life is not just the moment that you die for them. We see this in Philippians 2, 7 and 8. It says, "Jesus emptied himself by taking the form of a servant, being born in the likeness of men, and being found in human form, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross." And so we see in Jesus that his death wasn't just his giving over of his life, wasn't just the point of death, but the whole process by which he came down from his throne to enter into our realm, divesting himself of all the glorious accoutrements that bedecked him in his heavenly place. And Paul is saying that it's unnatural for humans to even consider giving up their life for righteous people. Consequently, it won't even enter our mind to give up our life for wicked people. There's not a line outside the Columbia Correctional Institution over in Portage of people waiting to trade their life for the inmates inside. There's not a line for that. There's not a single person in that line. People don't consider it as part of their love to go die in the place of people on death row or life in prison. We don't say, "Hey, I'd like to die for you. I'd like to give up my life. I'll take your life. You take mine." We don't think like that. But God is not like that. God and his love is radically different. It's not just a more pure love of the same kind. It's categorically different. It is holy love. Holy means set apart, markedly other, not like something else. God is holy, so also his love is holy. His love compelled him to give up his life for sinners, but not just sinners, but incapable. Paul says weak. It means not having the power to do something. Ungodly, unrepentant rebels. The Isaiah 53 that we read at the beginning, I read that in the New Living Translation. And most versions render this Hebrew word, pasha, as transgressors. That's what almost every version has, except for the NLT. It renders it as rebels. A transgressor is a perfectly suitable word if we understand what it means. But I don't think we often actually understand what a transgressor is. Most people think transgressor is like someone who trespasses. I've crossed onto somebody else's land. They didn't like it. They're offended. They want to shoot me, get me off their land, or whatever. The word in Hebrew that's translated as transgressors in most versions that the NLT translates as rebel means to be in revolt against the crown. It's insurrection. It's mutiny. It's not just a simple, I broke some laws. Psalm 2, this is what transgression means. Why do the nations rage and the peoples plot in vain? The kings of the earth set themselves and the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against his anointed, saying, let us burst their bonds apart, cast away their cords from us. See, we're not guilty of sin as though we're relatively decent people who really tried our best and I'm sorry, I was trying to stay on the road, I didn't see your no trespassing sign, accidentally went off it, no problem, not a big deal. That's not sin. It's that in the default state of humanity, our hearts are in active, remorseless rebellion, colluding together to overthrow the Most High God. God is the sovereign creator of the cosmos. He's the King of Kings and he's the Lord of Lords. And his creation is actively practicing insurrection. They're rebelling against him. They don't like his rule. Now, if you don't think you're included in that, you're like, well, that's not me. I'm not like that. King David would tell us otherwise. Psalm 14. The Lord looks down from heaven on the children of man to see if there are any who understand, who seek after God. They have all turned aside. Together they have become corrupt. There is no one who does good, not even one. Now, if you don't believe you're included in that number, you don't have to do it tonight, but go through, find all of the commands, all of the structures that the Lord lays down and says, this is who I am, this is how I operate, this is what I require, then test your heart and see if you actually desire to do those things, desire to do them for the glory of God, for his good, not for your own, because that's what God does. So you've got to be like God doing his things. Test yourself against the whole of Scripture. Test yourself against one simple Scripture. Bless your enemies. That's what God does. You go through and you will find that we're included in Psalm 2. We're included in Psalm 14. See, this disease of insurrection that corrupts the world and permeates every human heart is called sin. Capital S sin. Sometimes we get confused about this in English because in English we use sin and sins, but they're different things theologically. Sin is this corruption of the human heart that causes us to be our own kings. We want to be our own gods. We want to do things our own way. Sins are the individual things that come out of a sinful heart. Sins are the things that insurrectionists do. But the heart, the desires of the heart are corrupted against the Lord. This sin is a disease that worships self. We want things our own way. Sin exalts self against other people. Sin wants self to be crowned as the ruler. Sin doesn't like to submit to other people. Sin doesn't like to submit to God. Sin is an active rebellion against the Lord. And this is what God's wrath burns against. God's wrath doesn't burn against you went out and you smoked a cigarette. These are not good for you. It'll give you lung cancer and all sorts of other things. That's not what God's wrath burns against. God's wrath burns against insurrectionists who are actively trying to overthrow the kingdom of the Most High God. And God is not some petulant dictator who reacts in personal retribution at the most insignificant slight. He's not like some four-year-old that throws a hissy fit because someone stepped on their toe. Now, he's not like a four-year-old in a grown man's body who throws a hissy fit because someone cut in front of him on the road. That's not God's anger. That's our anger. Our anger is not like God's anger. God's wrath is much different. God's wrath is pure. God's wrath is holy. God's wrath is just. And it burns against rebellious mutineers who are trying to overthrow his rule, and his rule is good and righteous and just. He's a good and loving God, and so we're not rebelling against like a wicked king. We're rebelling against things that are good and good for our own souls. And our sin, the whole sin receives the just punishment of God's wrath that any rebel against the crown deserves. I mean, what good king wouldn't punish evildoers that are trying to overthrow his kingdom? Eh, don't worry about it. It's cool with me. Just let it slide. Just don't do it next time. One of the most despicable things about our sin, the collective sin, is that we have neither the desire nor the power to change such a condition. Think of your corrupted heart as either the diseased roots of a tree or the contaminated source of a river. If the roots of a tree are diseased, the tree will be diseased. The fruit will be diseased. You can't just get good fruit off a diseased tree by trying harder, by stopping things. You have to replace the whole root system. If the river source is contaminated, everything going downstream is going to be contaminated. You can't just try to pull out some contamination out of the river here and there because the whole source of the river is gushing out contamination. You have to replace the whole source. And Paul says, this is the very thing that we are weak to do. We're powerless to do it. We're incapable of actually changing the root source, of changing the source of the river. And so our hearts just overflow. You can try to cover it up. You can try to suppress the sin that's here. You won't do it for long. And often you'll just kind of move yourself into hiding. If you try to suppress something here, it's going to pop up over there. And this is, I think I was talking to somebody today about this. This is really why addictions and all these things kind of come up, is because we do these things to cover up all the ugliness here. We use alcohol and TV and video games and noise. We just try to cover these things up to make sure that this doesn't come out. That's the human condition. And that is the person whom God considers worth dying for. God looks at the fullness of human rebellion. He looks at the worst depravity that humanity in their sin can offer, all of its revolting abominations, and he decides to give up his life for yours. Not that the worst that you've been, not that the worst that you've ever done, but the worst that your sin could possibly produce. Because someone might say, well, you know, I was saved when I was a little kid, and I just really never did much of that bad stuff, so I'm really not a bad person. I'm pretty good. I'm a lot better than most people. Because you're considering yourself as accounting your sins, the things that have come out. You're not looking at the sin here. And if you let this go unchecked, apart from the grace of God, it would be just as wicked as anybody else. The only difference between you and Hitler is nothing. Oh, well, yeah, but he did all this stuff. You're human. You have the same sin, capital S, sin disease. God looks upon that person and says, I will willingly and joyfully die freely and without compulsion because I love. That's God's love. A human being at their very worst is the person whom God looks upon and says, that's the person I want to save. That's the person I want to be in my family. That's the person who I'm going to die. I'm going to give up my life for the wicked of the wicked. And God pours his love out into the heart of a sinner by the Holy Spirit. We have salvation, new birth. Paul says in Romans 9, 5, 9 through 10, since therefore we have now been justified by his blood, how much more shall we be saved by him from the wrath of God? For while we were sinners, we were reconciled to God by the death of his Son. Much more, now that we are reconciled, shall we be saved by his life. And when the love of God is effected into our hearts by faith through the Spirit of grace, we are justified. And justification means that a condemned sinner is declared righteous and made righteous, or accounted righteous and made righteous. An accounted righteous basically means that we receive the legal stamp of the judge, not guilty. Not that we've never sinned, but not guilty. The slate has been wiped clean. Made righteous means that the actual declaration of not guilty makes its way into the righteous works of the human heart. Declared righteous means that somehow God will work that declaration of righteousness out into the actual righteous works of a person. How does this work? Scholars call this imputed righteousness. Imputation means that the quality of one person is granted holistically to another person. So the righteousness, this quality of righteousness that Jesus has and lives, gets imputed to people, gets imputed to those whom have received God's offer of love. But that quality doesn't leave Jesus. Okay, so justification, salvation, whatever word we want to use here, is not like a $100 bill. It's not like Jesus has a $100 bill and he gives it to me and he no longer has it. That righteousness that Jesus has is imputed to me. Jesus keeps it. He's still righteous. So now I get the righteousness of Jesus, the actual legal standing of righteousness that Jesus has before the Father, and I get the actual outworking of righteousness that Jesus actually lived. But that's not the only thing that happens. Paul says that our sin is actually given to Jesus. In 2 Corinthians 5:21, he says that Jesus became sin. Our sin is imputed to Jesus. So we get the righteousness of Jesus, and Jesus takes our sin. Not the individual little, well, I smoked a cigarette. Jesus takes the sin. The sin, the wickedness, the disease. He takes the whole bit. It's a trade. I get the righteousness of God. He takes my sin. That's a pretty good trade. It's like when two people come together in marriage. What one brings in legally becomes owned by the other. But what happens when one person brings in something of value, maybe an inheritance? They have $100,000. They bring it into the marriage. But someone else brings in something of negative value, like a debt. Maybe they're in debt for $100,000. The inheritance and the debt both remain, and they end up canceling out. And so the inheritance, in effect, has no value, but it was because it was canceled out by the debt that the other person brought in. And so if I get the righteousness of Jesus and he gets my sin, but it remains with me because it's imputed sin, we kind of have a problem. Righteousness isn't that good because still got the sin deal here. Except Jesus doesn't keep the sin, does he? I keep the righteousness of Jesus, but he doesn't keep the sin. What does Jesus do with the sin? He takes it to the cross. Paul says it was nailed to the cross with Jesus and it was killed. Jesus took the sin and he killed it. He put it to death. He destroys the power of sin. He destroys the guilt of sin. He destroys the shame of sin. He destroys the punishment that sin brings. And so that all that remains for those who have entrusted their life to Jesus is the righteousness of God. The full, unblemished value of Jesus' righteousness. And when all that remains is the righteousness of Jesus, we are released from the wrath reserved for the rebels, the wrath reserved for treacherous mutineers, because God no longer counts us guilty. We've got the righteousness of Christ. That sin corruption is dead. It's put to death. Christ has received the punishment. He took it to the cross and died. He killed it. We're reconciled to God. There's peace between the person and God, because there can't be true peace if there's enmity there. I mean, you know this. If you're in a relationship and there's some kind of there's turmoil, there's anger between the two people, you can't be at peace. You know this. The same thing with God. There can't be peace with the holy God if there's some kind of turmoil going on here. But Jesus takes that turmoil of sin, puts it to death on the cross, and God is at peace with us, and we're at peace with God, and we can experience his peace, and we become free to live in the joy, the very joy of God, to experience the perfect relationship that Adam and Eve were meant to experience. That's good news. When we see the good news, we tell the good news. Paul says in verse 11 of Romans that we rejoice. More than that, we rejoice. We rejoice. Those who see the good news will be rejoicers. You want to test your heart. You can test whether you see the good news. Because if you see the good news, there's going to be some rejoicing. There's going to be rejoicing there, because if you understand what has been done for you, I mean, you rejoice over a football play. So if you have seen what has been done on the cross, there will be rejoicing present. Can you rejoice in the cross tonight? If you can't, it's because you don't see the good news. That's okay. The offer of love is still open. If you do not know the love of God, if you do not know this love, if it has not made its way into your heart and that rejoicing is not there, if you understand the love of God, that God was willing, look at yourself at your worst. Just look at your own heart. Consider the worst. I mean, and the worst that you've done is not the worst that you could be. Look at the worst. Just pile up all this junk, and God looks at that and says, no. Because that's the one I want. Look at Paul. Paul was a murderer. Paul hated people. Paul threw people in prison, separated families. And yet God said, nope, that's the guy I want. If he's willing to do it for Paul, he's doing it for you. You understand that this love comes for you from God. It gives you the confidence to receive this love and turn to him without fear, knowing that you will be welcomed and accepted and affirmed as a child of God. Yes, sin must go, desires must change, but God's grace will work such a thing. But if God says, I'm willing to come down from heaven, give up everything, die a torturous death on the cross for you, I want to offer this gift of salvation to you. What do you think? You're going to turn to God and then he's going to disappoint you? Right before this, verse 5, I don't have the verse up there, but it says, and this hope does not disappoint or put us to shame. You will never be disappointed in turning to the love of God. And it cannot disappoint. It cannot put you to shame. Just if you understand that what God was willing to do, you can turn to him without fear, knowing that he will love you because he's shown that he's proved it. For those who maybe you know it, you have received the love of God. It has been poured out into your heart and you've been justified and you enter into that salvation relationship. When we understand the love motivation behind the cross, it severely transforms how we view ourselves, the identity that we get. If your identity is as a child of God who has been pursued and loved by God, you are free. It frees you. If you understand that love, you are free from having to worry about what other people think of you. You are free from needing to exact revenge on those who sin against you. You are free from striving to prove something to yourself or prove something to someone else. You're free to find yourself in sin and get back up without heaping loads of guilt and condemnation on yourself. Not free to sin. You're not free to sin, but you're free to find yourself falling into sin, and you're free to get back up, knowing that God already saw you at your worst. Like your sin now, you think that surprises God? You think, oh, well, I died for you at your worst, but boy, that curse word really throws me over the edge. God saw you at your worst. If you understand that, it gives you the freedom to pursue his righteousness. Even we're going to stumble. You're going to trip and you're going to fall. If you know that God already loves you, it gives you the freedom to get back up without guilt, without condemnation, without shame. And you know, if we understand that God pursues even the most wretched of rebels, then you are free to view other people in love. Because if that's how God viewed the worst of sinners, then what ought our view of people ought to be? I was thinking really, really hard about this section, this closing section. And this verse from 1 Peter 5 came to mind, and Peter says that the devil prowls around seeking someone to devour. You get that imagery in your mind. A lion prowling around seeking someone to devour. That's what Peter says that Satan is like. But you know what? Here's the crazy thing. Often Christians act like lions prowling around seeking for people to devour rather than seeking for people to love. I see this, maybe I read too much news, maybe I read too many comments on Christian articles, but that's really what it seems like to me. We look for reasons to devour people. One of these school shootings, the survivor was a girl named Emma Rodriguez, Cuban American. She wore a Cuban patch on her shirt. You would not believe the hatred that was spewed towards that girl. Can you imagine being a 17-year-old teenager who was almost gunned down, who lost friends, and then because you're wearing a Cuban patch on your shirt, Christians look at you and say, "You disgusting person, go back to Cuba if you want to wear that patch." What in the world is that? We look for people to devour because we don't really know the love of God. We get into all these heresy hunting, and we test people by their knowledge, and do you fit into my categories? Do you believe this? Do you believe that? And if you don't believe this, ooh, Well, you want to know what good doctrine is? Primary doctrine? Righteous people love the Lord their God with all their heart, soul, mind, and strength, and they love their neighbors as themselves, and they bless their enemies. Okay? That's doctrine, isn't it? What's interesting is that Christians often, they're just off fighting about this little thing, that little thing. What's interesting is that they never judge themselves on that doctrine. You don't ever go after somebody and say, well, you're just really not loving like Jesus today. We say, well, I really don't think your view of God's sovereignty is right. I really don't think your view of God's justification is right. Doctrine doesn't mean anything unless it actually achieves, love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and love your neighbor as yourself, because that's the great command. And Paul says, it doesn't matter if you are literally the smartest person, you know all the prophecies in the world, you are the best theologian that ever lived. If you don't have love, you literally are nothing. Literally nothing. You can be talking all this angelic talk and doing all this crazy stuff, but if you don't have love, you just literally sound like clanging pots banging together. I mean, picture that sound in your mind. Is that an awesome sound or what? No, it's not. It's the worst. That would really get annoying very quickly. And that's what Paul says you're like. If it doesn't matter what you're doing, how amazing it is, how many good works you do, how much doctrine you know. What's amazing to me, I was a wicked person. If you knew me 20 years ago, none of you, maybe some of you, because you would have been right there with me, you wouldn't have said hi to me. I guarantee it. But God said, God looked at me, he looked at my heart, he said, wow, that is a rebel, that is a sinner, that is a depraved, wretched man, but guess what, I'm going after him. I'm going to go from heaven, I'm going to go to the cross because Aaron, that guy who is depraved in mind and heart, that's the guy, that's the guy. And so God looked at me. He was willing to do all that. He was willing to justify me. He was willing to make me righteous. He was willing to declare me righteous. He was willing to produce righteousness in me, whereby I'm not perfect. I fall short. But he's produced enough righteousness in me where I'm qualified biblically to be and operate in the capacity of a pastor, overseer, whatever. We're not just talking about quitting smoking or quitting drinking. We're talking about an utter transformation from a wicked person into a person qualified to live righteously as a pastor. Do you understand what God has done for me? And yet, there are people who would look at me and say, guess what? Because you are not wearing a suit while you preach. I'm really not sure, one, even if you're really mature, but I'm really not sure if you're even saved. Like, that literally happens. If we know the love of God that he has towards wicked people, you've got to understand, what did Jesus say? As people are putting him to death, Father, please forgive them because they don't know what they're doing. But boy, we are quick to jump all over people. At the minor mistakes, things they may not even understand that they're doing, beliefs that they might not even understand that they know or hold to that they don't understand, how it might be unbiblical or whatever, we jump on them and say, how can we do that, understanding what God's love is like for us? Ought not, if God was willing to pursue us with that kind of crazy love, ought not we to say to people, I'm willing to walk alongside you in all your brokenness, all your disgustingness, because I'm going to show you the love of God. And I will tell you the love of God. It doesn't mean a whole lot to just go out to someone and say, ooh, you're gross, you're the worst. I'm an amazing Christian and you're the worst. I mean, I don't know. I don't even know how to say it other than that. That's how it sounds to me, some of these things that I hear. If God is willing to divest himself, give up his life, his whole life, he's willing to give up his life for the worst, then if we know that as believers, how can we not do the same thing? How can we not first judge ourselves by the primary doctrine of love the Lord your God and all with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, love your neighbor as yourself, and bless your enemy? Let's compare ourselves to that doctrine, and then we can worry about this other stuff. Because this other stuff, again, if it's not leading towards that, what purpose is it serving? The end result of the cross is holiness displayed in love. Working together, intermingling. Holiness displayed in love. God's putting to death our sin. We're putting to death our sin. We're seeing how wretched it is. We're striving away from sin, and we are striving towards love, towards God, and towards others. The end result of the cross is not knowledge. Again, what we know ought to produce in us a disciple of Jesus who's following him, who's making other disciples who love the Lord their God with all their heart, soul, mind, and strength, who love others. If our seeing and telling of the work of the cross does not reflect God's seeing and telling of the work of the cross, then I don't think we see the cross that Jesus sees. We have an opportunity tonight to humble ourselves before the King through communion. And Paul says in 1 Corinthians 11:26, "For as often as you eat this bread and drink the cup, you proclaim the Lord's death until he comes." How does communion proclaim the Lord's death? What does Paul mean? I think in part what it means, when we take communion, we participate in the elements together. What we're saying, we're acknowledging, re-acknowledging that we were the sinners, that we're in need of the cross, and communion is open to people of any gender, any ethnicity, any language, right? There's no look to see who's qualified to take communion. It's not people who have right doctrine. It's not people who have better doctrine. Because guess what? We're all human. We all have the same corruption. We all have the same need of the cross. The only qualification to take communion is whether we understand that we need the cross. That's it. And it humbles us and it places us in the same community of sinners made righteous through Jesus as anybody else. We're going to watch a quick video. I'm not going to say anything else more about it. Up here at this table are these little spikes. This is roughly what Jesus would have been nailed to the cross with. I'm going to come up here, take one of these. There's little pins. It's a double meaning here. One, our sin put Jesus on the cross. My sin put Jesus on the cross. If there was only one sinner, it would have put Jesus on the cross. So I'm saying I'm acknowledging my sin was worth the death of Jesus. At the same time, I'm also acknowledging that my sin was nailed with Jesus on the cross. It's gone. It's put to death. It's done. And I live in the freedom of God's righteousness. So watch this short video. Come up. Take one of these. Nail it to the cross. And then take the elements.